Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe. I'm Thomas Hill. My guest today is the architectural historian Nicholas Adams, Mary Conover Mellon Professor of Art here at Vassar College. He's the motive force behind the grand exhibition currently on view in the main library, the art library, and the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center here at Vassar. The exhibit is entitled The Architect's Library and features books about architecture, mostly written by and for architects, between the 16th and the 20th centuries from Vassar Library Collections. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you.
Can you tell us how the idea of the exhibition came into being? What made you think there might be something interesting lurking in those dark aisles under the art library that drew you to do this exhibit?
Well, the origins of the exhibit actually go back a couple of decades in some ways. One of my predecessors was a very distinguished architectural historian, Richard Krautheimer, and I would visit him on occasions when in Rome, when he had time and would see me. And over lunch, at one point, he said, "Well, tell me, Nick, how is that wonderful Barbaro edition that the library has? Have you made use of that in your teaching?" And I felt a little embarrassed, but said, "Oh, I didn't know that we had a Barbaro edition." And he said, "Yes, but of course there's that Serlio, which is a bit late, but quite useful. You've used that, haven't you?" And once again, I had to say that I knew nothing about it and that this was material that was foreign to me. So I kept in my mind always this reproof from Richard and wondered to myself where these books could be, because they didn't appear on any of the library catalog lists, and the rare book collection, special collections at that point, was rather reduced in size. And I remember mentioning it to the then special collections head, and she was puzzled and didn't know about these things. So I had always the sense that I was, as happened not infrequently with Richard Krautheimer, in deficit, but I didn't really know how to get myself out of that situation. So this is to go back 20 years, and if you run the tape forward and run it forward quickly, a couple of things then came together. One was a visit that I made to Special Collections when the head of Special Collections, Ronald Patkus, pulled me aside and said, "Guess what? I've found a edition of Piranesi's Antiquities of Rome. You might like to take a look at it." And I said, "Yes, and where was it?" And he said, "Well, it was among the uncatalogued books." So I looked at it, was very impressed by the fact that we had this wonderful early edition of Piranesi's Antiquities, and I began to then ask whether there were other things. I indeed raised this question of the Barbaro edition, which at least at that point we couldn't find, but Ron continued to pull out more Piranesi's, and so in the end we had two or three. So I would say that was the first alarm signal, you might say, that there was something more here than met the eye. The second alarm, the second notice that there was more here than met the eye, came as you and I, in fact, made a series of walks through the art library shelves. I began to be concerned because I started looking up very obvious things that I somehow assumed that we had in the library, obvious books in history of architecture that I assumed were available. And it turned out that not only were they available, but in fact we had early editions of them. So one of the first things I pulled out, and I pulled this out on my own before you and I started walking around the shelves, was an edition of Pugin's Noted Contrasts from 1836. And once I had done that and then looked for a couple of other things, it turned out that many of these early books, particularly the 19th century, but I think we got things back to the 17th and 16th century, were still out on the art library shelves.
You know, you tend to think of libraries as perfectly indexed. And, you know, if there's something in the library, if you know where to look, you ought to be able to find it. And that is the case often for newer libraries. But the older a library is, the more probable it is that there's material in that library that's become buried over the years that may have been known about at one time, but that because of changes in indexing systems, and in our case, of course, we went from a Dewey classification to a Library of Congress classification,
exactly,
and lots of things got sort of pushed to the side.
Plus, Vassar in the 1950s, I guess, early 60s, it began to be an archival repository, and we got a lot of manuscript collections at that point. We also got books at that point, and those have not been cataloged or had not been cataloged. So we have things that are just lurking in the back, waiting to be discovered.
You hear about discoveries every day of manuscripts and letters, et cetera. And often these discoveries are materials that are found in libraries and museums. You know, they haven't been buried in the ground on a peat bog somewhere. They're things that are essentially in collections, but that no one knows they're there. And interestingly, the more rare something is, the more possible it is that it might be completely overlooked. And that's partly a cataloging problem in that there are lots of copies. Because we share cataloging with other institutions, it's likely someone else has cataloged the book and it'll go into the electronic catalog then and it will be easy to find. But with a rare item, it may be that nobody else has it and nobody's cataloged it and you don't have the cataloging.
Well, we certainly found with the Robert Owen material that we pulled out a few years ago that was an extraordinary collection, that much of that at the time was uncatalogued. So this great utopian thinker from the beginnings of the 19th century, once you had totted up the material that we had, turns out we have one of the major collections in the world, possibly the largest collection in the United States of Owen material.
Books aren't always acquired by libraries fresh off the press, but many have previous owners. So an individual volume can have its own history to tell. And you found some interesting traces of this kind of history in some of the volumes, the Pugin, for instance.
Yes, the Pugin is a very good example, because the first thing of interest about the Pugin is that it's a first edition, which is relatively rare. It lacks some of the more noted illustrations. But the ownership is very interesting, because its ownership record is for a Robert C. Long. Mm-hmm. Now, Robert C. Long doesn't mean much to most of us, but in fact, he is the Baltimore architect who introduced the Gothic Revival to that city. And he dates his acquisition of this book to 1836. So what we have is the major text, major polemical text on the Gothic Revival by Pugin, now in the hands of the most noted Baltimore architect, Robert Long. And in addition, there are a series of short pencil annotations, possibly in his hand, throughout the volume, notations where somebody, probably not a student, but somebody who is an architect or a builder, is commenting, "That's right. Yes, of course," when Pugin makes a comment about the despoiling in restorations, or comments on the poor state of neoclassical architecture. These things are underlined and commented on. So there's really a whole history of architecture contained in there. And in many ways, it's not atypical. So these books have ownership histories. And that, in a way, was the stimulus for our title. This is the Architect's Library. Mm-hmm. So here's Robert Long using the book, commenting in the book, and demonstrating that architects use books for inspiration, use books for substituting for travel, use books to disseminate their polemical ideas and to absorb them. So it's a wonderful example of the way in which the idea for the exhibit, with its focus on architects and architects' active reading of text, can become a theme.
So how did the project take shape for you? You decided to formulate a course around it. And as a librarian, I see faculty, of course, send their students into the library to do research projects on various themes, assigned or unassigned. But I can't recall anyone else ever sending a class into the stacks collectively like this to scoop out an entire collection for study. So can you talk about using the library in this way as a teaching tool and just what inspired you to turn the project over to a class?
Well, desperation was the first thing that came to my mind as I started surveying the number of books. I think there were a number of things behind it. One was, I found the process of looking at books and pulling them out not just revelatory, as I've suggested, or as is the case, about the book itself, but also about the book's history. And I thought this would make an interesting topic for students. Mm-hmm. The desperation came is that I had so many of them. How was I going to write catalog entries myself? It didn't seem appropriate, but I thought students would find it interesting and challenging. And be clear, I mean, Vassar doesn't offer courses in librarianship, nor does it have an advanced degree in architectural studies. But what we do have are students in the art history program who are trained at looking at objects. Mm-hmm. And books, in that sense, should be capable of being interpreted and examined by young trainee art historians. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I thought this was a kind of natural for them. Another part of it that was natural was, as often the case with students, you feel that while they can effectively master a relatively constrained and limited area of study, it's very hard to get them to, very hard because of their own lack of experience, to think about long-term significance of something. Mm-hmm. But in the case of architectural books, we have something very specific. We have a very specific writer. And in most instances, we have a succession of commentators who've come along later, people who've written about these books or people who've written about the architects. And this material is, in a sense, open to them. And with a little bit of research, a little bit of digging in the library, they can pull out things that explain the importance of the books that we were looking at.
Interesting. Books are artifacts, and many of them are very old artifacts. We don't always tend to think of them in that way.
Yes, and I have to say there was something really wonderful, and a number of the students had this response as they looked at the books. I know when the Repton volumes came out, and we looked at the way in which Repton demonstrated the before and after of landscape design.
Yeah, this is Humphrey Repton, the landscape architect.
Yeah, 18th century, early 19th century landscape designer. And there were really a kind of sense of ooh and ah that goes with this. Or, for example, the most passionate response I can recall, and it's really imprinted on my memory, was bringing out the House Beautiful volume, which is by Frank Lloyd Wright, very early Frank Lloyd Wright book, extremely beautiful, handmade paper, handmade prints within it, a book from 1897. And before opening it, the student who was presenting it stood very proudly over it and said, "This, quite simply, is the most beautiful book I have ever seen in my life." Mm. Now, at that moment, as a teacher, your heart melts because it is as if the subject has been taken on by people. The student was very interested later and brought this into her writing in the ways in which so many of the books, particularly the Palladian texts, had found their way to America. She was studying American history at that point. And so she was really able to, in a sense, see the true links between Italian classicism and Italian Renaissance and the American 18th century, in a sense, hold that in her hands. So I think there's also something very tactile about the way in which history can come alive as we look at books.
And you weren't just looking for beautiful books.
No, we weren't looking for beautiful books. And this was both the challenge and I think the interest. This is a collection of notable books. And as I started the project, one of the people I consulted with was the Swiss architectural historian, a man who has one of the great libraries of architectural books in the world, Werner Uexlin. And Werner, when I explained to him what I was doing, I was asking him whether I should be separating special books, rare books, books in perfect condition from those that were in the library, was very specific. And he said, "No, because for architects, it doesn't matter. Remember that the architect will use the text and the images that are to hand, whether it's a paper bank or whether it's a first edition from the 18th century. And if you can get that commentary, get that dialogue going, you can do very well." So what we did was, in fact, exclude modern reprints just simply from a practical point of view. But we didn't trouble ourselves, although one sometimes regretted it, to see books that had been rebound by the good intentions of the library.
Built to last. We used to talk about books and their permanent research value, meaning when we bound them in such a way that a Kodiak bear couldn't pull them apart. But you know, it wasn't aesthetically necessarily
a kind. No, and of course, in the process, very often one loses a cover. And equally, we didn't necessarily go, we couldn't go for the first edition. So I didn't think that in the end, from an educational point of view, that mattered.
No.
So for example, we have that really superb, tiny edition of the Antiquities of Athens, James Stewart and Nicholas Revitt's book, originally published in the 18th century, extremely beautiful and luscious edition. We don't have that, mm-hmm. but we have the 1841 edition, which is a pocket-sized book and a pocket-sized version of the Antiquities of Athens. Perfect. This is the book that you can carry in your hand, the architect can stick in his pocket or her pocket, and learn about the Greek Revival. So it's as relevant to architectural education and needed in the architect's library just as much as the first edition from the 1760s.
Yeah, sure. It tells you how the work was used. With architects carrying books around in their pockets sometimes, as you say, I wonder, how do I want to put this, why are architecture and books so bound up together?
Well, I think there are historical reasons having to do with the fact that books travel easily and mm-hmm. people don't, particularly in earlier times, that the needs for architects to see historic examples has really lasted throughout history. Mm-hmm. So the knowledge of, let's say, the Parthenon is still thought to be relevant to architects as they learn their trade, whereas I'm not quite sure how relevant the Venus de Milo is, let's say, to painters. There's another reason, and that has to do with the way in which architecture developed, and particularly outside of the centers. So American architects developed a whole series of pattern books. Mm-hmm. So books that repeated or took up the forms of historic architecture, great architecture of Greece and Rome, produced them in book form, and then could dispatch them off to the far corners of the United States and have the original sources of classical architecture be as available in Sheboygan as they are in Savannah, Georgia, let's say.
Then other architects could work from these. They could build yes. from the book, whereas a sculptor very rarely would look at an image in a book and work out an object from that.
Yeah, the necessity ultimately yeah. is that in order to make drawings, you have to produce architectural forms mm-hmm. in a flat orthogonal representation, that is to say, with all lines mm-hmm. being true on the page, in order to build it. That cannot work for sculpture. It can't work for painting, where sculpture you have to walk around in three dimensions, and in painting you have color and you have texture, size that matters. Architecture, you can put the measurements in and the book can be just as useful. I should say that this need for books is also therefore international, so it's not just the United States. But the farther parts of Northern and Eastern Europe also depended on pattern books. Ireland was particularly dependent on pattern books. Mm. Pattern books have a long history there. And Vassar has an interesting collection of these that came to Vassar very early on, though incomplete as any collection is.
So diving into a library collection in a concerted way like this, one realizes that a library isn't just a gateway to the past in general, a gateway to history, but that it holds evidence of its own particular past. And somewhere buried in the accumulation of paper and ink on the shelves are narratives about institutional origins, intentions, and engagements with historical trends and moments. And the catalog essays provide a wonderful sampling of this kind of narrative concerning Vassar College itself. And I wonder if you could talk about these, you know, what these books tell us about the founding of the college in the 19th century and also what they tell us about subsequent institutional concerns over the mm-hmm. years.
I think architecture and architectural books have an essential role in the founding of the college. Very simply, your name is James Renwick. You've been hired to build the first building on a female college ever. Where do you go? What do you look for? There are no models. There's no tradition of building women's colleges. Mm. You have to cobble together the ideas that you have in order to invent a form of building for a female college. That building is Main Building. It's the large Second Empire structure that stands at the center of Vassar College. But it's also clear that Matthew Vassar and the people who advised him, most particularly Elias Magoon, believed that art and architecture were essential elements for the education of young women. My colleague Brian Lukacher has a wonderful essay here in the catalog called An Education in Gothic for Vassar Female College. And in that essay, he shows how Vassar, through a founding trustee, Elias Magoon, arranged for the seeding of the library and of the art center with books and prints and paintings derived from Magoon's collection. Magoon had purchased this collection in England on the death of the publisher and antiquary John Britton. So Vassar received at an early moment a very large collection of drawings, prints, and books, partly because it was felt this was material that students needed, but also because they believed that an education in Gothic art and Gothic architecture provided a vision for a proper kind of religious training in the history of architecture. The interesting thing about Magoon is that though he was a minister in the church, he'd worked as a mason in his early years, and architecture he thought of as the emblem of the divine on earth. Mm-hmm. Thus, it had a prominent place in his collection. Magoon and Vassar, as Professor Lukesha writes, drew a direct line from medieval England to the aspirations of America. So despite, as he says, the Gothic apogee of architectural achievement that could be studied in the Magoon collection, the historical lesson was to legitimize the Middle Ages. Among the books that came to Vassar College as a result of Magoon's interests and Vassar's interests were a whole series of books on landscape and architecture, in particular the books of Andrew Jackson Downing related to the history of landscape. Vassar had commissioned Downing to work on the construction of a house at Springside in the south side of Poughkeepsie, and then the books that Vassar himself owned were donated to the college. Mm. So what we have is the confluence of the English architectural studies from Britain with Vassar's collection of Andrew Jackson Downing and the rural architecture movement in the United States. So if you put these things together, what you get is a major new building in a major new architectural type. You get a moral underpinning and historical underpinning from England and the United States through the study of landscape and the study of Gothic architecture. And this forms the early nucleus of the materials in the Vassar Library. How things develop from there is more complicated. Mm-hmm. I think over time, in the latter part of the 19th century, as funds were established for the library and donors found, gifts were made, some of them following from those early gifts of Vassar and Magoon, although it has to be said Magoon did sell his collection of Vassar. So we have the arrival of books donated by alumni. The second major moment of Vassar's expansion came as a result of an extraordinary gift from the Carnegie Foundation. This was the moment when Vassar built its art library, and the Carnegie Foundation added books and filled out the collection.
This is in the 1930s.
This is 1935, and Vassar hired its first art librarian, Mildred Steinbach, to oversee the library and hired its first curator. But the moment that really stands out really has to do with the relation between the college and the Museum of Modern Art. Not only were Vassar women and alumni involved in the foundation of the Museum of Modern Art, but a number of Vassar faculty had close ties to the museum. So the faculty member who was responsible for the design of the art library, John McAndrew, who taught from 1931 to 1941 at Vassar, made sure that we had in our collection the major texts of Le Corbusier, examples of the early Bauhaus Bucher, and other early texts in the history of modernism.
And most of these are sitting on the shelves in the art
library. You can take off. It's a second edition of Bale's Une Architecture, but it was sitting there right out on the shelf. The Le Corbusier catalog for the Museum of Modern Art was equally out on the shelves, a relatively rare volume. It's really just a typescript. And they were just sitting there waiting to be discovered by people. Mm. Many of these also come with inscriptions. So, for example, one of the Bauhaus Bucher is actually given by McAndrew and is signed by him, and then also where he purchased it, at Dessau in 1929.
Very early.
These are very early Bauhaus books.
Shall we talk about some of the individual highlights in the exhibit? Maybe touching on the three periods that are especially well represented. The 18th and early 19th century books that have to do with the Grand Tour, and then the Gothic Revival material, and then finally the Modernist.
You raised the issues of the Grand Tour, and I think of the Grand Tour as a place for paper tourists. These are books that were brought back Mack and Vassar is quite well represented. We've got a range of works by Piranesi, for example. Yeah. These are the things that came out mostly, all uncatalogued, including the views of Rome on the magnificence of the architecture of the Romans, 1761, the Roman antiquities from 1784, and then we have these very late works that are kind of problematic and not as finely executed, this book on vasi and candelabri, vases and candelabras, which we have in a two-volume edition. There are other things. And then alongside these, a whole series of books that clearly had a role in bringing back to the northern countries memories of Italy, not just the Piranesi, which is obviously, in a way, the star of any architectural book exhibit, but the drawings, for example, of the book of Charles Tatum, which is a series of etchings. We have a third edition from 1806, but Tatum is a very interesting figure. He leaves for Rome from England in 1794, together with the painter, well studied by my colleague Brian Lukacher, Joseph Gandy, painter-architect Joseph Gandy, with the task of obtaining designs and antique casts and decorative sculpture in Rome. And Tatum becomes concerned that Piranesi hasn't selected the best examples. And so his book represents a kind of a succinct representation of the parts of the classical world that he thinks are better suited for copying and for study, in effect correcting the imaginative excesses of Piranesi, both in the style and in the selection of his images. There's a wonderful reference to him by the architectural historian Howard Colvin, who describes him as severely neoclassical and almost brutalist in character. So a book like that allows you not just to see the great monuments of the ancient world, but then also teaches you a little bit about the ways in which taste changes. So from Piranesi's imaginative excesses, you can go to the restrained views of Tatum. And in addition to this, the whole series of books, of illustrations, the kinds that tourists brought back, showing the Rome of the 18th and early 19th century. Moving forward, you have also what is really a superb collection of 19th century books. These are the ones that came in part from Vassar and from Magoon. But it clearly was something that the art librarians in successive years looked out for, so that we were able to fill out those collections with later works of people like Robert Willis and Wuhle. Viollet-le-Duc is very well represented. A whole series of Assises de Caumont comes in, and the spectacular work of Lassus on Chartres, so that one can really look at a full range of the rediscovery of Gothic English, French, some in Italy and in the United States, with the development of Gothic Revival here. So you've got a second area, which is very important. And then the third area that I would probably draw attention to is that area that was brought by MacAndrew, as MacAndrew brought modernism into the art library, not only by building a modern art library, but then by making sure that the main works on modern architecture were represented there, whether it's the works of Wright or the first edition of Hugh Ferris's Metropolis of Tomorrow, Eric Mendelssohn's fascinating America.
It's a large picture book.
Large picture book of 1926.
Skyscrapers, in which City of Detroit figures prominently, I notice, as a Detroiter.
Detroit at its heyday. I think the interesting part is that when the collection begins, when Vassar begins, we bring in the mid-19th century. The 18th century is brought in the early 1900s, and then modernism comes and is brought in the 1930s. So we get this rather extraordinary range of books brought in at different time points.
Most of the modernist material appears in the art library exhibition case.
And, yes.
The case has a kind of title, The Demise of the Architecture Book? And I wonder if the architecture book is dead or died somewhere in the 20th century. Doesn't serve its purpose.
Well, I think things happen to change the status of the architectural book. Mass travel has played an important role. It's no longer necessary to communicate the information about these works far away in book form. The development of economic opportunities for printing meant that books didn't have to be or were not as rarefied in their production, so that we also have a decline in quality and appearance. Magazines change. We get the introduction of color printing, and color printing continues to go down in cost throughout the second half of the 20th century, with the result that magazines can substitute for books.
Yeah, that's the way architects communicate with one another, in a sense, isn't it?
Yes, the short essay becomes more popular than the treatise or the large book. That said, I mean, you can get a book like Rem Koolhaas's Small, Medium, Large, and Extra Large, which...
It's an extra large book. Huh?
It's an extra large book, and it sweeps the field.
Yeah. One of a kind, though, I should say. There have been many.
Yes, often imitated but never duplicated, I think would be the expression about that book. Yeah. But there are also small books that are important. Robert Venturi's Complexity and Contradiction, or his book on Las Vegas. These are books that are still popular. But with the exception of Koolhaas's, they don't have quite the same effect, or not intended to have quite the same effect, as the books of the 18th century, whether we're 19th century, whether we're talking about a Belly d'Or, we're talking about a Kent production.
The earlier material, when you're looking at it, you can almost read the intentions of the authors, and those intentions have to do with the fact that as this book is published, the world is going to look a little different, that these works are going to have an influence on the built environment. And that there's an idea that they're actually going to have some effect on the way the world looks to us.
Yes.
In the 20th century, I don't know if that's... Well, certainly that is the case with Corbusier. Who's a force. He takes up one quarter of our modern case there, and you feel you really should give him more space because...
Well, writing mattered to Le Corbusier. Yeah. I think he filled out his application for his ID in Paris, described himself as an homme de lettres, and there's a wonderful book by Christine Boyer which describes Le Corbusier, the writer. Writing mattered. He felt that it was an important project and part of the project of creating a new architecture. But it's not clear that architects have the same feelings today in general, although it's always possible that someone will come along who transforms the field through a book. It's obvious today that more energy is devoted to blogs, to accumulation sites, and to presenting material in a transient form than is spent creating material that will last the way the book does.
Yeah, sometimes I think it's important just to get the image out. I mean, you can see it with Frank Gehry. Everyone knows what his buildings are shaped like, and then...
Yes, the image is everything. I mean, there is a certain kind of eye candy that the magazine offers, and the book doesn't really offer that. But I think in general, you're absolutely right. Although that said, and I know this from having worked with architects at different times, they still retain an admiration, an affection for the book. All the stuff that comes out that they produce, the sort of fluff that comes out through their public relations machines. But if you look at a firm that I know reasonably well, like Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, the people who write books, they're the serious people. Nat Owings very especially wrote books, although not himself, as my late mother would say, from the writers, not a gifted writer. It was terribly important for him to get his ideas in book form. Only then would they last, and only then would they matter. That's another view, and I suppose we could change. I mean, we could go back to a world in which the long-term vision, the long-term process matters, and books will once again be important. It's hard to see our way through to that at this time.
Yeah, interesting. As solid a thing as architecture is, and there is no more lasting solid art, most of what we know about the architecture of the past comes down to us not in remnants of buildings, but in books.
And
so you wonder if we do lose this textual tradition, if we will lose the present essentially in the future.
It could be. I mean, it's certainly true that many books contain, and we have a good example in the exhibit, the Dugdale edition with Wenceslaus Hollar of St. Paul's. This is the book that really tells us what St. Paul's looked like before the fire of London in 1666. This is the one thing that can tell us what Inigo Jones intended. In any book on Inigo Jones, and any book on English Renaissance architecture, any book that wants to cover that material, reproduces Holler's etchings of the front porch at St. Paul's, mm-hmm. because there's no other way of really knowing about it.
Yeah.
Yes, there are drawings and so on and so forth, but this is the completed building.
Which leads me to my last question. I'm personally always fascinated by book exhibits as a reader, because as a reader, they force me to look at books in a different way than I'm used to looking at them, insofar as the books and the cases are presented as objects, not as books to be read, the way we do ordinarily approach a book. I mean, a book is, interestingly, something that it exists in the visible world, but we regard them almost as invisible things. You know, we tend
yes.
to look through them to what they represent
sort of
to
content,
us.
Yeah.
Yeah, and very rarely, as you will in a book exhibit, often will we read a title page. You know, you look at the title page and make sure you picked up the right book, and then you dive into the text and you don't see the text either. But, you know, looking at books and cases, it's a different way of looking. And so, you know, I wonder about the relationship between the book as an object and the book as a text. And later this semester, I'll be talking on the program with the media theorist, Wolfgang Ernst, friend of Brian's, by the way, who in his approach to the past emphasizes physical over discursive media, you know, hardware over software, so to speak, in a practice he calls media archaeology. And he has this wonderful chapter entitled In Defense of Antiquarianism. And in it, he writes that for antiquarians, history is not just text, but the materialist emancipation of the object from an exclusive subjection to textual analysis. And he goes on to talk about antiquarians having a monumental relationship to the past. And, you know, as I was reading his book, I was thinking about your approach here. And this is an exhibit about the importance of books to architects, but it's also an exhibit in which the book is presented as a monument, in a sense, mm-hmm. like an architectural mm-hmm. object itself. And I know you do teach architecture that way often. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll take your students out to look at buildings. So I just wonder about if you have any thoughts about the relationship between these approaches, and keeping in mind this notion of antiquarianism, which is antiquated, of course. It's the way history was done in the early 19th century, but when scientific history came in, it was made to be quaint. And serious academics will regard what goes on in museums as kind of quaint.
I suppose. Yeah. You know, one of the things I tried to talk with students about as we were looking at this material was to have them think not just about the text and not just about the object, but how text and object interrelated. The volumes of Le Corbusier are a perfectly good example. They're shaped almost like guidebooks mm-hmm. or manuals. That's important. You can't get that from a reprint if it's the wrong size. You can't get that from the screen. You only can get it if you hold it in your hand and realize that, like the Michelin guide or like the text about the manufacture of the car engine, you can stuff it in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
You can throw it down on the table. It's got consumable paper covers, and that's a part of its story. We talked earlier about the Revett and Stewart edition of the Antiquities of Athens, and seeing it in that small format mm-hmm. may not be the best way to appreciate the works of ancient Greece. I would certainly argue that you should go to Greece to see them. I'd prefer, perhaps, for accuracy, to look at the superb large-scale editions of Stewart and Revett that came out in the 18th century. But the one that we have gives you a sense of what it actually meant when you could turn it into a pocketbook. When you could, as it were, carry it with you next to your heart or next to your body in a way that meant it could be a continual work of reference. And so I'm sympathetic with this idea that the object carries its own story, and we should not only be lost in understanding the text and stop at the text, because it's how it looks on the page, the size of the book, the kinds of characteristics the paper has that all tell the story. Our copy, for example, just to give another instance, our copy of Pugin is rather ruined. I mean, it's mm-hmm. heavily foxed, and the ink has decayed some of the paper. Ah, but that's important. I have a pristine reprint of the contrast, but the ruination of the paper is part of the story. Pugin didn't have a lot of money. This is a young man's book. It's put together hastily, and if you see it in its reprint form, you'll never understand how this book existed in its own time, how these ideas were perceived, because they didn't come out in a book that was in beautifully laid paper and finely printed. It came out rugged in its character. Mm. It's an angry young man's book. And one can go through over and over looking at each of the books, in a sense, and thinking about why size matters, why shape matters, why color matters, why bindings matter. Mm-hmm. And each of these carry their own history. So I'm very sympathetic to the idea that each object carries its own tale.
Yeah.
And we cannot let the text be the only thing that we look to. I'm always impressed by this wonderful history of architectural theory, as thick as the telephone directory used to be in Manhattan, stuffed with information about what these architects wrote. It doesn't say one word about how these books were produced and what that production tells us about the larger world those ideas inhabited.
Yeah, we think of the past as invisible partly because of print, and that our idea of the past is of this invisible world that we imagine.
Yeah.
Even though we're tripping over the past, wherever we go physically, there's a lot of it that remains, but we don't tend to think of it in those terms.
No, and I think you're right that the exhibition, if you can look with that in mind
mm-hmm.
and take yourself off from the text, our books strangely have an extraordinary texture to them, in part because librarians came along, students came along, they've been handled, mm-hmm. they've been used. The text may have been important for architects at one time. In some cases, we've got architects' comments in the margins of these books. In other cases, we have student comments in the books. And one could regret that, and maybe they should be erased. But it's all part of how this text was originally created and then how it's used today.
It's been used, yeah, great. Beautiful catalog, beautifully illustrated.
Yes, yes. We were very lucky in our design and in our designer, Abigail Sturgis, mm-hmm. who provided us with a really superbly crafted piece of work.
You could, going through the catalog, the first thing that popped into my head was that it could function as a textbook and an introduction to architectural history, at least as a secondary text
yeah.
In that classic works by architects through the ages tell you something about those architects and their concerns.
Yes, I would just add to that that we asked people writing their entries, as you well
mm-hmm,
know,
I know,
to do three things only: to tell us who is the author, what's the book about, and why is it important? These are simple questions, but not necessarily easy to answer. So it does function in that respect as a kind of textbook. I can't say that in all instances our entries are perfect. Anything mm-hmm. done under deadline is always going to have problems. But it is what we tried to do, and we tried to make these as tight and as useful as possible.
Mm-hmm. So I want to thank you, Nick, for joining us on the Library Cafe today to talk about the exhibition, The Architect's Library, a collection of notable books on architecture at Vassar College that will be on view through the end of May of this year across four venues: the Rare Books Library, the Art Library, the Main Library, and the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center.
Thank you very much.